Today is Monday, January 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, the coronavirus transmission ability is getting stronger and infections could continue to rise as more than 2,700 people have been infected thus far.
From our observation, the disease can be spread during the incubation period. The incubation period lasts for 10 days.
Plus a look at the president's defense in his impeachment trial, and the Auschwitz concentration camp was liberated 75 years ago today. We take a look back. Those stories and more are next. The coronavirus's transmission, the ability seems to be getting stronger, and infections could continue to rise, according to China's National Health Commission, with more than 2,700 people globally affected and at least 80 in China being killed by the disease. Reuters' Edward Buran starts us off.
The ability of a new coronavirus to spread is getting stronger, China's National Health Commission said on Sunday, as authorities in the country and around the world scrambled to prevent a pandemic. More than 2,000 people have been infected globally, and dozens in China have been killed by the disease. This the latest from the country's health commission minister.
From our observation, the disease can be spread during the incubation period. The incubation period lasts for 10 days.
The fact the virus is infectious during incubation makes it different from severe acute respiratory syndrome, or SARS, a coronavirus that originated in China and killed nearly 800 people worldwide in 2002 and 2003. A handful of cases have been reported outside China, including in Thailand, Australia, the United States and France. On Sunday, Paris-based Chinese associations cancelled a parade, with Paris Mayor Anne Hidalgo saying they're really not in the mood to party right now. China says knowledge of the virus is limited and that containment efforts, which have thus far included curbing transportation and travel, and the cancellation of big events would be intensified. The virus is believed to have originated late last year in a seafood market in the central Chinese city of Wuhan that was illegally selling wildlife. That city of 11 million is now on virtual lockdown, and on Sunday China announced a nationwide ban on the sale of wildlife in markets, restaurants and on e-commerce platforms.
That was Reuters reporter Edward Buran. VOA's China branch was able to reach out to an American teaching at a university in Wuhan. She asked that her name not be used for fear of Chinese retribution and told VOA's Mandarin service that neither the consulate or the U.S. embassy in Beijing has yet contacted most American citizens of the city.
I called the embassy because the initial reports were saying they will evacuate us on today, on Sunday, right?
Right.
So I called the embassy last night, and I spoke with an operator, and she told me that is false. There is no charter flight today. Now the reports are saying there will definitely be a charter flight on Tuesday. I'm still doubtful. And anyway, like, what they've said to us is that if there is a plane, if you want a chance to possibly be on the plane, you need to, by yourself, email American Citizen Services. They are not reaching out to us. Maybe they have reached out to a few privileged individuals, but on the whole, they are not reaching out to average American citizens. We have received almost no support and no help, and the consulate staff are the ones who are being prioritized on any medical evacuation. So if there is a chartered flight, the priority is the consular staff and their families, the diplomats, and any remaining seats, the current information that I've seen, any remaining seats would go to quote unquote vulnerable people. But they've told us that we need to register to be added to a list, to maybe have a chance to leave, and then also we are required to pay for the costs of the flight. My actual current feeling is that, first of all, there are thousands of us Americans in Wuhan. A 747 seats like 250 people. they're not going to take everyone out. Even if every single person wanted to leave, they would not take all of us. So that's one. And two, I have a cat here and there's no one who can take care of him. So I'm not going to leave him to starve to death in my apartment. Everyone keeps telling me, that's insane, save your life, get out. I'm not going to, like, leave my best friend in the whole world to starve to death alone in an apartment. Like, it's horrifying. So I don't think I can go anyway.
How stressful is it? Is everything? How's your mental state right now?
Really not good. I've never experienced anything like this. This is the craziest experience I've ever lived through in my entire life. I wish it weren't happening. And it's a nightmare.
That was an American citizen teaching at a university in Wuhan, China, who asked that her name not be used for fear of Chinese retribution, speaking with our VOA Mandarin service. President Trump's lawyers have started their impeachment trial defense, arguing Democrats are trying to overturn the 2016 election. The AP's Sagar Magani reports from the White House.
With the Senate in for a rare Saturday session, White House counsel Pat Cipollone argued the president did nothing wrong in dealings with Ukraine, and Democrats know it.
They're here to perpetrate the most massive interference in an election in American history.
Cipollone and other lawyers repeatedly accused Democrats of holding back key facts during their 3 days of opening statements, promising senators will now get the truth in longer sessions next week. Minority Leader Chuck Schumer says, great, let's have more information, saying the Trump presentation underlined Democrat demands for witnesses and documents.
We thank the president's counsel for one thing. They made our case even stronger.
Sagar Magani at the White House.
Before the trial resumes later on Monday, we're going to take a look at the arguments being made by the president's team. For that, I spoke earlier with Bruce Ackerman. He's the Sterling Professor of Law and Political Science at Yale University. I began our conversation by asking him what he made out of the short arguments that the president's team made on Saturday.
The crucial question is whether more evidence, more witnesses are required, or whether at the end of the week, the Senate, by a vote of 51 to 49 or something like that, will say, okay, we've heard enough, and we're going to move immediately to a final vote. It seems to me that the president's initial presentation only emphasized the need for more witnesses and evidence.
If we look to the future, what is a possible impact that this Senate trial could have on future impeachments?
It would create a terrible precedent for the future if, on the basis of all of this evidence that has been already advanced by the House managers, the Senate decides, no, we've heard enough, and we're going to proceed very, very quickly to a very partisan close vote that will acquit the president of all charges, because this will set a precedent for the future. 10 or 20 years from now, another president, he might be a Democrat, he might be a Republican, will be facing a hostile House and Senate, perhaps both chambers, and will be engaged in another set of abuses of power. After all, we're dealing with human beings, not angels. Will he be able to say the Senate 10 years ago held that the simple abuse of power is not sufficient for conviction? Yes, they did. And I'm going to use the Trump precedent to engage in my own forms of abuse of power and say, we've already passed the question, we've already passed the hurdle. You have to find that I was guilty of a particular crime, which is, of course, very hard, much harder to do than to establish that you are, that the president has been engaged in a systematic abuse of power, using powers as president to undermine the fundamental commitment that the Constitution imposes upon him, which is to take care that the laws be faithfully executed.
If we take a look at the actual arguments that Trump's team is making,
yes,
you know, how do those stack up?
We're not going to be able to really assess things until the end of the third day. You know, we have to give lawyers for the president the benefit of the doubt. And we'll see what we think after all 3 days are used up. I'm sure that the arguments on Monday and Tuesday will be much more elaborate and developed. The crucial claim made by a leading Harvard law professor, Alan Dershowitz, is yet to be heard, Dershowitz argues that the notion of high crimes and misdemeanors, that's the constitutional phrase, has to be interpreted very narrowly so as to require the commission of a crime.
That was Sterling Professor of Law and Political Science at Yale University, Bruce Ackerman, speaking to me from his home in New Haven, Connecticut. And you're listening to VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
People have long linked stress to gray hair. Now a new Harvard University-led study describes why this happens. After proposing several theories they couldn't validate, the Harvard investigators turned their attention to the sympathetic nerve system, which controls our body's fight or flight response. They found that these nerves spread into hair follicles on the skin and that stress can cause these nerves to release a hormone that is absorbed by stem cells that convert to pigment or color cells for new hair follicles. The researchers say this hormone stimulates the stem cells to convert into too many pigment cells, essentially draining the supply of stem cells that were to generate color for future hair follicles. They say that once these pigment-producing cells are gone, it's not possible to regenerate anymore. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Security forces and protesters clashed in Baghdad and other Iraqi cities on Sunday as authorities attempted to clear sit-in protests. Reuters' David Doyle has that story.
Iraqi security forces fired tear gas and live rounds in renewed clashes with protesters on Sunday, security sources and witnesses said, as they tried to clear sit-in camps across the country. Demonstrators are seeking the removal of what they see as a corrupt ruling elite and an end to foreign interference, particularly that of Iran, in Iraqi politics. Their protests have been bolstered by supporters of populist cleric Muqtada al-Sadr, who have, at times, helped shield the crowds from attacks by security forces and unidentified gunmen. But on Saturday, al-Sadr said he would end his involvement in anti-government unrest. Shortly afterwards, his supporters began withdrawing from sit-in camps. And after that, security forces removed concrete barriers near Baghdad's Tahrir Square, where protesters have been camped for months.
The current government is illegal because it came from bogus elections. The people have been rejecting it for 4 months. Yesterday and today, thousands of students returned to protest sites despite the force being used by security forces. We appeal to the international community to protect us and to support our people against this corrupt and tyrannical government.
The unrest has resumed after a lull of several weeks, following the killing of top Iranian commander Qassem Soleimani. Medical sources said at least 14 protesters in Baghdad and 17 in Nasiriyah were wounded on Sunday.
That was Reuters reporter David Doyle. In addition, at least one person was wounded when three rockets hit the U.S. embassy in Baghdad on Sunday, according to a senior Iraqi official speaking to the AFP news agency on the condition of anonymity. One of the rockets hit the embassy cafeteria at dinner time, according to a security force speaking to AFP, while two others landed nearby. The U.S. State Department told VOA that they were aware of reports of rockets landing in the international zone, but would not comment further on the security situation in Baghdad. On Friday, thousands of supporters of Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr, whose party won the most number of seats in the May 2018 parliament, gathered in central Baghdad for a rally to demand that American troops leave the country after a drone strike ordered by Washington earlier this month killed a top Iranian general in the Iraqi capital. Al-Sadr said that if the conditions were met, the resistance will temporarily stop until the last soldier leaves Iraq, referring to the American troops. Ambassador James Jeffrey is the U.S. Special Envoy for Syria and the Coalition Against the Islamic State. He said, quote, "We have a strategic framework agreement with Iraq since 2008. It covers economic security and diplomatic engagement across the board, and we're prepared to discuss with the Iraqi government our overall strategic relationship," end quote. VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi discussed these developments with Ismail Al-Sudani, former Iraqi military attaché in Washington.
In fact, Muqtada al-Sadr is a controversial personality. No one can deny the significant role of Muqtada al-Sadr in Iraq's political life. His bloc, Syroon, is the largest bloc in the parliament, according to the most recent elections in Iraq. This demonstration comes weeks after the escalation between Iran and the U.S. that ended in exchanging the strikes between the two countries inside Iraq. He called the millions to join the demonstration. Of course, the Shia political parties, especially those who owned armed groups that accused being linked to Iran, have joined this demonstration or the rally. In my perspective, it reflects al-Sadr's ability to mobilize the Shia community and his supporters towards his political objectives. It also shows Mr. al-Sadr's substantial impact on the streets. Although Mr. al-Sadr is part of the political process, he is also taking part in the ongoing anti-government protests. The demonstration is delivering messages to the U.S. administration that they are willing to escalate the situation if they refuse to pull out the forces. At the same time, it sends a support message to Iranians against the U.S. strike that targeted General Soleimani in Baghdad. Iran, of course, they are delighted that Iraqi Shia political parties have succeeded in bringing these numbers of people to rally to demand the U.S. forces withdrawal from Iraq.
Al-Sadr said if the conditions were met, the resistance will temporarily stop until the last soldier leaves Iraq, referring to American troops. Considering the past experience of resistance after the U.S. invasion of Iraq, is his threat a credible one?
The credibility of this warning depends on a condition he set in his statement, which is the U.S. forces leaving Iraq. So he is throwing the ball in the U.S. administration's court to react and pulling out the forces from Iraq. He is halting the resistance temporarily now. That means he has never given up resisting the U.S. forces in Iraq since 2003. But if you look at the situation today, it's different than in 2003. The U.S. forces mission, role, size, and locations are totally dissimilar to those in 2003. Therefore, considering the violence against the U.S. forces is expected, we cannot omit this kind of threat. But apparently, this threat sent a message to the U.S. forces and the U.S. administration, we are serious to counter your presence in Iraq.
Ambassador James Jeffrey, the U.S. Special Envoy for Syria and the Coalition Against the Islamic State, said, "We have a strategic framework agreement with Iraq since 2008. It covers economic, security, and diplomatic engagement across the board. And we are prepared to discuss with Iraqi government our overall strategic relationship." What's your take on that?
The strategic framework agreement has generally outlined the security issues, but not the current presence of the U.S. forces in detail. The U.S. forces' presence in Iraq since 2003 has been regulated via diplomatic notes from the then Iraqi government to U.S. administration. And that was an urgent request from Iraqi government to the U.S. administration to send the troops to counter ISIS at that time. It had addressed the role, mission size, and location of the forces. Therefore, the request keeping the forces, reducing the numbers, or asking them to leave should be negotiated between the two governments according to that new regulations, not the strategic framework agreement.
And that was Ismail al-Sudani, former Iraqi military attaché in Washington, speaking to my VOA colleague Mohammed el-Shanawi. The United Nations Refugee Agency welcomed a ruling by the UN Human Rights Committee this past week that people fleeing climate-related and natural disasters have a valid claim for international protection. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The case in question concerns Ion Teitiota, a man from the Pacific island of Kiribati, whose claim for protection as a climate refugee was denied by New Zealand. The UN Human Rights Committee, which reviewed this case, agrees with that decision on the grounds that he was not at imminent risk. Nevertheless, the committee says people should not be returned to their place of origin if it is shown that climate change is a threat to their right to life. The UN Refugee Agency hails this a landmark decision. UNHCR spokesman Andrei Mahecic says the decision has potentially far-reaching implications for the international protection of displaced people affected by climate change and natural disasters.
It underscores the importance of countries taking action to prevent or mitigate against harms associated with climate change, which in future could otherwise force people to leave, triggering then international obligations. And secondly, that this ruling recognizes that the international refugee law is applicable in the context of climate change and disaster displacement.
UNHCR Special Advisor on Climate Action, Andrew Harper, says the fires in Australia, melting glaciers, flooding, drought, and other devastating climate-related disasters should be a wake-up call to action.
I think the ruling can be, the decision can be summarized by saying, if we do not do more to prevent, then we will inevitably have an obligation to protect. If we do not succeed in providing the resilience, the capacity for communities to survive this climatic catastrophe, then we'll have to be doing much more on the protection front.
Harper says it is impossible to anticipate how many people could be displaced by climate change. He notes those most vulnerable are people in small island developing states, Asia and Africa, most of whom are too poor to leave. The UNHCR is calling for urgent action to help vulnerable communities mitigate and adapt to the changing climate so individuals do not feel forced to leave their homes. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Monday is the 75th anniversary of the Allied liberation of Auschwitz, perhaps the most notorious of the death camps during the Holocaust, when over 6 million Jews and others were systematically murdered. Ever since, Holocaust survivors have considered it a sacred duty to keep the memory alive, partly as a cautionary tale to help prevent future genocides. But 75 years on, that generation is dying out, and soon, only recorded testimonies and books and films will convey the horrors of that time. To find out more about the Holocaust and film and its role in helping us remember and understand that catastrophe, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Columbia University film professor Annette Insdorf. Insdorf is the child of Holocaust survivors and the author of the 1983 book Incredible Shadows, Films and the Holocaust, which has been updated 4 times and remains the classic work on the role of film in conveying the unspeakable.
Already in 1979, I was exceedingly aware that the further we move in time away from 1945, the more people will remember, in quote, will think of the Holocaust in terms of images from movies and television, because there won't be anyone left at a certain point who can speak as a witness. Fortunately, Steven Spielberg, among others, took it upon themselves to create archives of Holocaust survivor testimony. But the average viewer, the average individual, let's say, with a heightened sensibility who doesn't just go to movies for popcorn fun, entertainment, escape, but goes to movies because he or she wants to be illuminated, transformed, that person is unlikely to go to survivor testimonies or to the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum. But if a Schindler's List is playing, or let's say even a foreign film like Life is Beautiful, might learn about the Holocaust initially through these motion pictures.
Why is it important to remember the Holocaust at all? I mean, history is full of horrors. And why use film to do it?
I think there are at least two reasons. There is, first of all, the uniqueness of this historical event, precisely because the scale of the Nazi extermination of European Jewry was so extreme. There had never been anything like this kind of mechanized killing, and it's terribly important to know that this did happen. The second thing is that while the Holocaust is utterly unique, it is absolutely connected to other attempts at genocide that both preceded World War II and followed World War II. Look at Rwanda in the 1990s. You can go further back and look at the Armenian genocide that preceded World War II. And you realize that as soon as the persecution of an entire people, whether it's based on the color of their skin or their ethnicity, their religion, once that becomes government mandated, we are in a territory that is so dangerous. We have to be vigilant, because any time a dictator can come to power and decide that one kind of people is less worthy of life than another kind of people, there has to be a rising up of no. There has to be a negation of the impulse towards destruction of an entire people.
How have you used your work in film studies at Columbia and your book to promote this awareness and remembrance and warning?
I'm primarily an educator. I've devoted most of my adult life to presenting students with the best of motion pictures, not only in terms of how well they're made and how they reflect the world in which they were made, but also how can they sensitize us into becoming better human beings. I am deep down a humanist.
Of course, at this point, there are hundreds of films about the Holocaust and Holocaust themes, many of them very sentimental or just crudely made or inaccurate.
I prefer to have fictional versions that might sometimes sanitize or trivialize elements of the Holocaust than nothing at all.
Schindler's List from 1993 won 7 Academy Awards.
Of course, Schindler's List tells only one sliver of the history of the Holocaust, and yes, the focus is on a savior who was not Jewish rather than on the victims who were Jewish, but it was a noble effort to, in fact, open the door of Holocaust awareness, and it played a tremendous role around the world in doing that.
That was Annette Insdorf, professor of film at Columbia University and the author of the 1983 book, Incredible Shadows, Films and the Holocaust, speaking to my colleague Adam Phillips in New York. Kobe Bryant, one of the NBA's all-time greatest players whose international stardom transcended basketball, was killed at the age of 41 on Sunday in a helicopter crash near Los Angeles, along with his 13-year-old daughter and 7 others on board. Bryant rocketed to fame as an 18-year-old rookie and played 20 years for the Los Angeles Lakers, 18 of them as an all-star, winning 5 NBA championships. His death sent shockwaves through the National Basketball Association, which he helped propel to global prominence and stun fans around the world. The cause of the crash is unknown, and an investigation by the FAA, or Federal Aviation Administration, and the National Transportation Safety Board could take months. And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jimmy Cook, thank you very much for spending your morning with us. Be sure to visit our website for update news and world events 24 hours a day. And you can also find archived copies of the show on our program page under the Live Radio tab. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day.